Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. To find out about my background, rajbalkaran.com/academia. More importantly, I have the pleasure of speaking today with Dr. William Ellison. He is now Associate Professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, in the Department of Religious Studies. Hello, William. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on the program, Raj.
Well, thanks for coming on. We are talking about his most fascinating book, The Neighborhood of Gods, The Sacred and the Visible at the Margins of Mumbai. So The Neighborhood of the Gods, tell us a bit about how you got into this project.
Yeah, so this project, it's taken a very long time, and I start off my acknowledgments by describing it as an enormously long gestation period. It originated not only in my dissertation, but in some pre-dissertation work I was doing when I was a very tender, callow graduate student. So the nub of it is that I had thought early in my grad student years that I wanted to do something with film studies. I was a kind of Bollywood addict. You know, in a way, this was a rebellion against my training in the history of religions. As you know, I'm a professor of religious studies these days, and I ended up writing a book about gods. It didn't start out that way. I went to Bombay to escape from my graduate program, to find something that I could be interested enough to dedicate myself to study for years. And I thought that was going to be in film. And I wasn't looking for gods. I wasn't looking for religion. I ended up getting an invitation to tag along with a film shoot at one of the most famous Bollywood studios, Filmistan Studios, which is still up and running, but its glory days were in the late 40s, the 50s, and the early 60s. So I found my way inside this studio, and I learned that there's a section of the studio that's called the Village, and it's used by film producers as a village set. They dress it up in all kinds of ways. They shoot all kinds of scenes there, but primarily they're scenes that are kind of characterize their exterior shots of a small community, typically a sort of rural or rustic community. So inside the village set, there were people, and I learned that they were actually, you know, they were the villagers who lived within the village set. And here was the story that I became intrigued in. And as I kept on getting deeper into it, I learned that the village set had actually been a village before it was turned into a set, that the entire area that was now a film studio in suburban Mumbai, had originally been a village, that the village set was the kind of remnant or fragment that was left over after the studio wallahs, the producers had created a compound, had built a compound around a plot of land on which to construct sound stages and exterior sets. And then, you know, as my inquiries progressed, that the villagers belonged to a tribal community, so-called, an Adivasi community. They're members of the Varli community, and they have Adivasi gods. There's a little structure at the entrance to the village set that looks like a little artificial shrine, a little Hindu shrine of the sort that, you know, are ubiquitous actually on Indian film sets. I learned that it was not a fake shrine, but a real shrine consecrated to the tiger god, Vag or Vagoba, who is worshipped by Varlis and other tribal groups in Western coastal India. And that's how I went from neighborhood to God. That's how I went from film, thinking about films, to thinking about neighborhoods, to thinking finally about gods. And here we are, you know, many long years later. The book has finally come out, and I'm not a film studies person. It turns out I was a religious studies person all along.
So it was a path of self-discovery as well as academic research.
It was that.
So you lay out your encounter with the village in chapter one, if memory serves. What's the main thrust? What's the main argument of the book?
The main argument of the book, okay. So there, it developed that I pursued two distinct inquiries, and to distill it, the argument of the book is that what people are doing in my first inquiry is the same thing that people are doing in my second inquiry. The first inquiry has to do with the residents of this little studio, this little village enclave inside a studio, and their maintenance of the sacred geography of the village, in contestation of, in spite of, the makeover of their village as a film studio by a different social constituency, by the film industry, by the people who run the studio, by the film producers who come in routinely and, you know, cover up the landmarks of the old village geography and dress it up as, you know, whatever the shooting script calls for. So I was interested in the maintenance of the stations of the Adivasi gods in the continued importance and meaning of sacred landmarks like the wells and groves of special trees. That's sort of inquiry one. Inquiry two has to do with the streets of downtown Bombay or Mumbai. When I did the bulk of my field work, in 2003, there was a campaign that was orchestrated by people speaking in the name of the public interest. And as I have argued in the book, and as many of my colleagues who are more oriented towards urban studies, urban geography, urban anthropology, as opposed to religious studies, that is, as I argue along with these colleagues of mine, generally, when there are civil society movements in urban India who speak for the public, their constituencies tend to be overwhelmingly middle class or professional class. So this is a sort of bourgeois movement. And the movement, its purpose was to clear the public streets of so-called illegal religious structures. For those of you who are listening who aren't familiar with this term, this is the official English term that's used in India by the government and by English language journalists to describe something that is such a common phenomenon in urban India, and in fact, in urban South Asia, we could say, as to be virtually ubiquitous. It's the little sites of worship that one encounters, that all pedestrians encounter when they're walking down the street or walking along the sidewalks. In Mumbai, the major religious figure who is enshrined on the streets is a historical, charismatic Sai Baba of Shirdi, who has managed the rather remarkable feat of being both a, he's recognized as an avatar by Hindus and as a peer, as a saintly holy man by Muslims. So he crosses that divide. And indeed, you know, according to his, the principles of his creed, he encompasses all religious paths, not only Hinduism and Islam. Okay, so sorry to come back around to finally answer your question, Raj. And this was supposed to be the, you know, the thumbnail sketch of the argument, my elevator pitch. I'm afraid we're already on the 120th floor or something.
William, are you an academic by chance? Are you a scholar by chance? I'm teasing.
No, I'm a scholar.
No, as an academic, it's almost expected that there'll be a footnote or two within your verbal response.
My students, when I'm lecturing in classrooms, you know, I tend to go off on these excursies, and then, you know, I'll catch myself and I'll say, to return to the original sentence, here's the end of the sentence. So in both scenarios, you have relatively privileged people who are acting to erase or elide visual traces on the landscape of the presence of gods or other manifestations of divine power. And you have less privileged groups. In my argument, I identify the builders of illegal religious structures, primarily with subaltern groups. I see those little shrines, illegal religious structures, as extensions of slum neighborhoods. So, you know, in the Indian urban context, a slum is unauthorized housing for large groups of people, over half of the population of Mumbai, in fact, for people who whose right to occupy their dwelling place is not legally recognized. And by extension, the gods who are worshipped by such communities, likewise, are in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of the state, their squatters, their residence is illegal, hence illegal religious structures. So to sum it all up, my argument is what the builders of illegal religious structures are doing on downtown streets and what the members of Adivasi communities are doing in areas of the suburbs that up to a generation ago were wooded, you know, and it was the jungle, as people kept on telling me. And sort of conventionally, nobody questions in an area where there are a whole bunch of trees, you know, it's the wilderness. Well, of course, wilderness type people, Adivasis, tribal people, that's where they live. That's where they, quote, naturally, unquote, live. Of course, they worship rocks and trees. That's what tribal religion looks like. You don't think about tribal religion, or you don't think about local gods, deities that have the power to sanctify discrete spaces in material space. You don't think about that as an urban phenomenon. But there, I finally reached my elevator pitch. My book is about local deities in urban space.
So at the heart of this book about local deities in urban space, when I say at the heart, there are a number of threads. I think part of the reason why this book is so rich is because there's a wide array of data. It's rich in data, but it's also very rich in theory, because you're very much reworking and revivifying the very theory you're working on. in addition to the data, you're trying to understand through the theory. So maybe a fruitful approach would be to talk about the ways in which your book either bucks or extends or validates certain theoretical lenses. And also, it's a very, very quick comment. As you talk about your own work being more similar to folks who do urban anthropology or urban studies, it's very similar to so many of us in religious studies, in that, you know, my work may arguably have much more similarity with someone in literary studies than other Salvationists. And so that's quite common. So maybe we'll talk about the data after you address this, but what does your book add or sort of correct in terms of our theoretical understandings of studying space in this way?
Yeah, thank you. So here I promise to keep it short, because if I went rambling on a theoretical tangent, I think that would probably drive away whatever podcast listeners we still have with us. So I'll just make sort of two quick assertions. One area where I see myself as extending a theoretical inquiry, where I'm being constructive with social theory, is to theorize darshan, what's known as darshan in Hinduism and in related Indic traditions. In other words, ritually structured visual exchange with between a human subject and a divine personality. And so this is an encounter that's mediated, it's structured through ritual and mediated through through an image, through a visual interface, a visual or plastic interface, you could say, murti, conventionally translated as idol or image. And I'm emphasizing the visuality over the materiality of the murti in my argument. I want to think about this encounter in terms of subjectivization, and specifically building on I got here, by the way, via film studies. I've been reading a bunch of film studies influenced by Lacan. I'd been reading Lacan, went back from Lacan to Kojève, in fact. And his model of recognition as structured by what he calls the master-slave encounter. This is actually a gloss of Hegel, so we're getting like very kind of hardcore here. That's what spoke to me as a means of understanding what goes on in the darshan encounter, and specifically in the darshan encounter in a context, a modern context, a contemporary urban context, a context that is characterized by the proliferation of images, of visual representations of gods and other divine or semi-divine or venerable beings. A modern urban scenario where contact or interaction with such sacred images is not monopolized by a community of by an elite community of priests, in other words, Brahmins, who are sanctioned to oversee the ritual exchange. If you take the middleman away and you open up the landscape to a plethora of objects that are sort of making a bid for for the darshan gaze, for the pious gaze, how do we theorize that? How do we know? How do we to bring it to the very kind of matter-of-fact, earthy language of my fieldwork interlocutors? How do you know which gods are real and which gods are fake, right? This sort of Lacan meets Kojève meets Hegel, pretty abstruse, psychoanalytically oriented philosophizing. This is what gave me the concepts, the conceptual equipment to understand what's going on with darshan in on the streets of present day Mumbai. So that wasn't very short, but I did say I wanted to make 2 points. The second point, I will make this short. In colloquial Hindi, so I was talking with my interlocutors a lot about real and fake in Hindi, asli and nakli, what's real, what's fake. We often would pivot from asli and nakli to two other very common colloquial Hindi terms, kaccha and pakka. So kaccha is kind of raw, underdeveloped, undeveloped, nascent, blurry, sketchy.
Half-baked.
Very nice, yeah. And then fully baked, you know, is pakka, proper, ripe, permanent, correct, concrete, clear, legible. So these two, you know, terms sort of, they anchor a continuum or a spectrum or something, a range of stages of coming into clarity, coming into permanence, making a clear, legible claim. So if you have a kaccha shrine or a kaccha image of God, the claim to the space that shrine or image marks is not very clear. It's not legible to a public composed of many people who perhaps have diverse ways of recognizing the presence or trace of God on the landscape. The more pakka you get, I guess I'm talking here from the perspective of the person who erects the shrine or maintains the shrine, the more pakka you get, the more solid your claim is, the more respectable and the more recognizable, there's that word again, your assertion that, yes, this is sacred space. And, you know, in parentheses, by extension, you, the public, need to respect the claims of the community that is attached to this sacred space.
And would you say that's evidenced in the space in and of itself, or is it evidenced through how the caretakers of the space regard it and present it?
Right. So that's a wonderful question, and I understand that primarily as a methodological question. What I'll say is, you know, it to make the strongest case possible, it needs to be both, right? I have my own readings or observations.
Luckily, I'm most interested in your perspective. So.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, I guess my second chapter is sort of organized under the rubric of walking tours, where I'm your guide. You know, you, the reader, come walking with me along some of my favorite pedestrian routes through downtown Bombay, and we'll make stops from one shrine to another, and I give my analysis based not on an exclusively iconographic reading of the shrine's imagery, but iconography is one factor. You know, I'm trying to bring things, to carry things into an engagement with this theory of recognition. So, I give my interpretations, my observations of a set of exemplary shrines on a continuum, starting from kaccha, kind of crudest, most nascent, most tentative, to pakka, most officially, you know, firmly planted, here to stay. Now we are a real temple, that kind of thing. And I've also tried to supply the testimony of people whom I got to know, people whom I interviewed or pursued more committed relationships with, you could say, and working with their statements about, on the one hand, their sort of instrumentalist reasons for setting up or running a shrine. You know, some people, I think, can be quite walled about what the what's at stake in the claim to a little corner of space in this enormous, bustling, very crowded city where everybody has anxiety about living space. And then on the other hand, you know, talking to my interlocutors about the metaphysics of the sacred, I guess, that sounded kind of pompous, but, you know, how is this actually supposed to work? What, how does an image or a murti or a structure in which you seat the murti, how is that connected to the presence of a divine personality who might be named Sai Baba or who might be named Vittal or Vishnu, you know? In what sense is God instantiated in the at this spot that you have marked as sacred? How does it all work?
And their response?
I got a whole range of responses, certainly. But my favorite response, or set of responses, a whole philosophy, in fact, came from a person whom I consider a friend. We have a kind of bumpy friendship because oftentimes he's very free with his philosophy, with his theories about everything. And oftentimes what he tells me is so weird that I feel compelled to argue back at him, which, you know, like might not be the best kind of method to follow as an ethnographer. But then again, I'm sure that I'm not alone as an ethnographer who finds his interlocutors exasperating at points. Okay, anyway, among his many theories are a very well thought out, among his many theories is a very well thought out, and at points imaginative, but at other points perfectly orthodox, theory of how gods are instantiated at sacred sites, both sites that he sort of takes charge of as the, he'll describe himself as the priest. He calls himself an Adivasi Brahmin, which is a tribal Brahmin, which is, when he first told me that, that was one of the things I couldn't wrap my head around. But it's his claim to being as an individual endowed with kind of priestly talents or aptitudes within his tribal community. So both shrines that he looks after and also sacred sites that other people control, but that he visits and at which he recognizes sacred power. So he has a lot to say to me about this. I don't want to tie myself all up in knots. But the kind of pithiest definition he gave to me ran along the lines of electrical equipment, where he said, you know, power, shakti, has to be channeled from out there, from its source, which is, you know, sort of by definition, it's distant. And our job as religious subjects, perhaps especially as religious virtuosos, is to bring it safely, to channel this volatile substance and safely ground it at a place at which we can then access it. So then he, you know, went on to talk about grounding stations, wires, on and off switches, short circuits. At a certain point, I might have lost the thread because he understands electrical wiring better than I do.
It's a fascinating analogy. Often it's the case I find that there's the language of charge or being charged with reference to spiritual power. So would you say your book is about gods that are more marginalized than other gods, or the sacred itself being marginalized in this arguably secular space?
I'm sorry, please.
It's not a trick question. I sense there's both going on there, and I wonder how you would present the weight of that distribution.
Right. Let's see. I don't want to get really abstruse and theoretical about this, and I fear if I'm not careful, that's the direction in which I'm going to, head. Okay. I think the way I want to answer your question has to do with the visual interfaces through which different kinds of people attain a perception of the divine presence. And one thing that is being marginalized in modern Bombay and perhaps across India is cultic activity like the cults of sacred trees and rocks, sort of swayambhu forms or self-manifested forms, sites at which gods are understood to have manifested themselves in natural phenomena, unmodified by human intervention. Sites like that, and we're including some of the most celebrated and indeed to this day popular sites of worship in thoroughly orthodox Brahminical Hinduism. They fit within this category. I realize that, but I think that as a mode of looking at space, as a mode of looking at the landscape that recognizes the divine presence on the landscape, this is kind of it's receding, especially among communities that are relatively marginalized or disempowered. It's understood to be both non-modern, backward, to use the colloquial Indian English expression, both backward and relatively less efficacious. So I think, what I'm seeing is quite a broad phenomenon is the enhancement, the what I call the puckification of natural phenomena by human intervention. People will seek to make the outlines bolder, to apply paint to rocks, for example, to make them stand out. And if you see puckification as kind of a long process, what may start out one year as a sacred stone or let's say an anthill, next year it might have paint on it and a rudimentary structure erected over it. As the cult community grows, as the name and fame of this site spreads, as more people come in, as perhaps more influential, more powerful, more upper class or more upwardly mobile people join within the cult community, the site itself materially and visually becomes enhanced, becomes more pukka. So I see a shift away from recognizing the divine in kutcha forms. And then ultimately, where the argument ends up at the end of the book is to come back around to the film industry and to think about Mumbai as the home of it's not the only home of the Indian film industry, but it's the highest profile one. It's also the headquarters of the Indian media industry, kind of writ large. There I'm thinking about the kind of the most pukka forms, the slickest, most modern looking ways of imagining and imaging deities. I see a trend towards what I call spectacularization, both in the way that people imagine and inhabit urban space, and in the way that people nowadays, self-consciously modern people, encounter sacred space. So I hope that wasn't too like much in the theoretical, like woo woo kind of.
Well, it's all about the journey, isn't it? Sacred, secular, this idea of sacred versus secular, it comes up a lot when thinking about teaching about broaching South Asia. And I think that distinction is particularly important for what you're talking about. Is that an imposition from the Western world, or is there such a is there a distinction between sacred and secular in India, in your opinion?
Oh, yikes. Yeah.
Maybe related to the ways in which, for example, this law against, what was the term, the illegal, what was the exact term that you used?
Religious story.
Right.
Illegal religious practice.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that? When you're walking down, it's hard for someone to have get a sense unless they've been to India and walked down the streets of Mumbai or really anywhere, where you see that in every cash register, on every rickshaw, pretty much every block, there'll be a murti or an icon, there'll be incense. It's just so interspersed with even the public sphere that it seems to be... demarcation between sacred and secular seems to be quite tenuous in the South Asian context. And I think a lot of where your data sits, it's in that line. It's in that blurred boundary. So I thought you may have an interesting perspective on that distinction.
Well, so I have this ambition, which I will tamp down to engage your question sort of like head on and comprehensively. But instead I'm going to punt and I'll say that, you know, as one South Asia scholar to another, we both have an understanding of the kind of layered meanings of that term secularism. And in a specifically Indian context, secularism, denotes a kind of, it's an ideological position. And it's for those of you folks who are listening who are not familiar with Indian or maybe South Asian discourses on the relation of the modern state to religious practice, maybe I should explain that I think to translate it into U.S. terms, the closest analog to secularism is multiculturalism. Secularism in the Indian context means in public space, we recognize that all religions are valid, that they're all, that you can be Muslim and you're as authentically Indian as you would be if you were Hindu. You can be Christian and you're as authentically Indian as you would be if you were Hindu. It's not like the kind of commitment to the prohibition of religious symbols in public contexts of the sort that you see in France, for example, with what I think in French is called laïcité. Rather, what Indian secularism insists on is a kind of even-handed acknowledgement of diversity. And for that reason, I think, you know, multiculturalism is probably a good analogy here. Okay, anyway, so having laid out that definition, one point I can make about it is that this, as an ideological position in recent years, this is a position that has increasingly come under some strain, a considerable amount of strain, given the orientation of the current Indian national government. Setting that aside, though, I think that one of the implications of my argument in this book is that secularism is taken most seriously. There's the most thoroughgoing commitment to secularism in such a way that the principle has an effect on policy, on the organization of urban space. This is really a kind of middle class or upper middle class concern, and that you might certainly find a commitment to the principle of religious diversity among the kind of subaltern people with whom I primarily did my research, but that they understand it in a different way. And that while for somebody speaking in the name of secularism, like these public interest activists whose campaign to have the shrines removed from the streets I was following, they're talking about things like the rule of law, about the separation between public space and private space, and about how if you claim a section of an urban sidewalk for, let's say, Durga, then you are, by implication, denying that block of sidewalk to people who don't worship Durga. Attitudes towards those positions are very different among the kind of people who actually do build the shrines.
Now, you have a chat. I mean, you have obviously you have a number of fascinating chapters, and you're welcome to pull from any of the data from when you'd like. I'd like us to talk a little bit about your chapter on Sai Baba. I think it's chapter 3, because it's such a fascinating figure that has such global proportions in this corner of India and Maharashtra in general, and Mumbai especially.
Yeah.
And when I was speaking earlier about your book being rich because of the data and also because of the theory, I think one of the things that really resonates is that you enrich your theory according to the data. You modify the theory based on what you encounter. For example, with Sai Baba and as a Pukka image, and the ways in which it's a great example of this mutual recognition of darshana, which isn't always the case. Often scholars in the field may hold too stringently to a theoretical model, and the data may not fit as well. Let me talk a little bit about what you discover with Sai Baba and how it helps you theorize darshana.
Well, first of all, I mean, that's a terrific piece of flattery. Thank you very much, Raj.
Well, the check is in the mail, right? You mailed the check. Right?
The Supati, as we would say in Bombay. So the relation of Sai Baba to the kind of ambitious way that I'm trying to re-theorize darshan, the best example, the aspect of my chapter, I think that if there's a part of it that comes close to deserving the very kind thing that you said about the primacy of the data, or about research directing the course of theorizing. It's the part that builds on a critical reading of the the central scriptural text of the Sai Baba cult. This is a text called the Sri Sai Satcharita. It was written in Marathi in the early part of the 20th century. And it describes a compendium of celebrated and edifying episodes from the life of the holy man earlier than the 20th century, in the last few decades of the 19th century primarily. Okay, one of the primary concerns, it turns out, of Sai Baba's followers was with the kind of technologies of visual reproduction that were just becoming important in Indian culture at this juncture in history. That is to say, industrial technologies of reproduction through printing, like lithography, chromolithography, and photography. And Sai Baba was one of the earliest, he was one of the earliest figures to become prominent, to become widely known through the circulation of his sacred image as captured first through photography and then reproduced through lithography and circulated in easily accessible forms. Yeah, it was a theological question for his followers as to whether these images, these copies, these two-dimensional copies of the real, living, flesh and blood, materially instantiated holy man, in what sense could these copies be said to hold sacred power, to hold religious power? Would interacting with the copies in some way turn out to be efficacious? Would that be an efficacious way of channeling the energy, the shakti, as my Varli friend would say, of Sai Baba, who's the source, the earthly source of this divine power? And the answer, as given by the man himself and as elaborated and conceptualized by his followers, by his interpreters, is emphatically yes. Yes, worship the photograph. Yes, the photograph. He is quite unequivocal, actually, and this is remarkable for a person whose many venerated utterances generally tend to be kind of gnomic, or, you know, like he tended to speak in riddles. But at one point after another, he's quoted as having unequivocally said, "The photograph is me. I am in the photograph. You will receive the full benefit of my presence if you try and see me in the photograph, if you open yourself up to seeing me and being seen by me through the photograph." In short, it's an explicit endorsement of darshan via photographic means. I this is by no means a coincidence, but it seemed like quite a revelation when I did discover this by reading the Sri Sai Satcharita, that, yeah, the most explicit theological endorsement of worshiping God through a so-called visual copy of God comes from the figure who, in Bombay anyway, is recognized as the most prominent instantiation or visual manifestation of divine power. He's the guy who supplies the explanation.
Well, it's obviously fascinating. It's a fascinating revelation of the understood mechanics of the transmission of shakti, or the divinization of the embodiment of the murti. Mm-hmm. How does this impact your study or what you're arguing? Like, this is crucial. This is a fascinating insight. And how does it color or impact what you're saying in your book?
Well, for one thing, it's a way to engage with the question of copies, you don't need to be working in a context where the field of sight is just saturated with the artifacts of the technological reproduction of images as present day Bombay is. I guess in a sense, I might be kind of going above my pay grade here, but in a sense, you know, the problem of copies is the problem of representation itself. Mm-hmm. But to have Sai Baba on record as saying this, to have a theological argument again from, and it's not just from within Hinduism, because Sai Baba's ambit is broader, right? He's speaking, I would say, I just made a connection here. He's speaking, according to him, on behalf of all religions. I would amend that to say he's articulating a position that he expects to be meaningful, to be understood potentially as correct by people who belong to all religions, but again, here's my amendment, Indian people, South Asian people who might belong to all religions. So here's the connection I just made. I think that this is a position that seems, yes, that is logical. Yes, this makes sense. Yes, this is the way that I approach sacred images. It's more compatible with what I was talking about as the kind of subaltern alternative to the modern ideology of secularism. Now, just sort of one footnote here, since I'm all about the footnotes and the, you know, explaining my own explanations. That's not to say that any, let's say, piece of paper that is printed with a graphic representation of some god or saint or divine figure belonging to some religious tradition is therefore by definition sacred. That's not what he's saying, that's not what my interlocutors are saying. Rather, it's opening up the potential for that, right? And it's opening up the question of whose recognition of divine power or presence within a given image or object, whose recognition is authoritative? Whom do we trust? And how is that claim asserted, recognized? How is the claim of recognition itself recognized? How is that built on and fostered and ultimately made pakka? It kind of opens up the field.
Yeah, that's sort of a fascinating line of thought. As you were talking about the, how do you call it, pakkification? Well, you know, the term shaktification has been uttered. I've used that term because nothing really, there's no what? English equivalent. Shaktification, when something is shaktified or someone's shaktified. But
noting you.
If you give me license to use pakkification, you can use shaktification wherever you like.
It's a deal. I love it.
So when you're talking about this process of pakkification of the perhaps one Swayambhu,
yeah,
perhaps an iconic mm-hmm. Murtis or sources of divine power that then become pakkified through community, through ritual, through perhaps rabbinical patronage. Mm-hmm. You know what really comes to mind? It may be an interesting point of data at some point to think about is in Maharashtra, there are these four of the 52 Shaktipithas in India. Mm-hmm. I believe there are four of them in Maharashtra. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, I've been to all four of them because I was in Pune doing Sanskrit some time mm-hmm. ago. And it struck me that some of the Murtis, a couple of the Murtis are extraordinarily and iconographic, as you may find. Mm-hmm. And some of them are very ornate, like they're like Mahalakshmi at Kolhapur, for example. And so one wonders if they have undergone this process you're speaking about, that they may have once been these sources of local power that were inornate and recognized by a handful of people in the middle of the wilderness,
yes.
as it were, before you know, villages really were built around them, and they are perhaps the result of this process. It's just a thought experiment.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think I would love to extend that thought experiment. And I believe, you know, let me take a step at giving credit where it's due. I think that there are many people who have who've studied sites like this, maybe even specifically in a Maharashtrian context. D.D. Kosambi comes to mind. But the example that I would give to give kind of more pukka shape, in fact, to your thought experiment is the figure of Dattatreya, who is a Brahminical god. For listeners who don't recognize that name, he's typically portrayed. His iconography, better yet, typically incorporates the so-called Hindu trinity of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, three heads on one body, the body of a kind of youthful male figure, a young cowherd, in fact. And he is named as the presiding deity at many celebrated temples, sites of worship with Brahminical sites of worship, so temples that are staffed by Brahmin priests. In Maharashtra, also in and adjoining areas of Karnataka and Gujarat, so his purview is very much northerly. No, not even. Anyway, it's Western India. Okay, historians or people, you know, engaged in research in a kind of historiographical mode at these sites have demonstrated that Datta is a relatively recent accretion in most cases. In some cases, in fact, the site only became known as a site that's sacred to Dattatreya, in the 19th century. I don't think anywhere in Maharashtra is there evidence of a Dattatreya site being a Dattatreya site before, let's say, I'm on shaky ground here, but I think the 16th century. And previously, they were goddess sites. So this is a very concrete set of examples of pukkification, of it's one of the things that I read the, let's say, acquisition of these sites by Dattatreya as signifying is the Brahminization of local cultic sites. So the goddess, who's typically, you know, a village goddess or a very local deity, a territorial deity, is transformed into a Brahminical and translocal deity.
Well, that's that obviously resonates. My primary research initially for the first book was on the Devi Mahatmya, which
right.
is the first Brahmanical iteration of this probably tribal deity, Durga.
Oh, wonderful.
So maybe two questions before we wrap up. The first question is,
project is I'm sure. You can't ask that question. Yeah.
Which question? Sorry.
What is your next project?
That's usually what I end with. I mean, there's so much in the book that we haven't even touched on, but are there any of the case studies or main themes that you wanted to talk about, or you expected to share about, or anything that really surprised you or impacted you from any of your interlocutors?
Oh my gosh.
I know there's so much, right? But I just want to make sure that we don't leave anything crucial on the table that you want to talk about.
You know, I don't think so. I'm really grateful to you for having read the book so carefully and given me such well-shaped questions, so that in responding to you, I feel like I've been able to give a very good account of the points in my argument that I think are important or potentially interesting to others, and aspects of my research that I want to call attention to.
Great. So then the dreaded what now?
Yeah,
what next?
Thanks.
So what now? What next?
Wait, you told me. What now? What next? Okay, I'll tell you one thing that, you know, perhaps I'll succeed in saying this in some kind of well-phrased way, or, you know, what follows may have to be edited carefully. But I think what next is, I want to push some claims that I've made in my argument further, and I want to do some sustained and close-grained field work, returning to Mumbai, working in so-called slum communities and slum colonies, busties, and following up on some theoretical propositions that I made that I think are just kind of, they're just opening the door on what could be a really promising set of inquiries. One is a proposition that I can state, I think, quite simply, which is slum colonies in Mumbai and other major Indian cities tend to be founded, built, and settled by labor migrants who come from villages. They come together from villages. So village deities are coming to the city. Some of, you know, the most urban deities in India in 2019, a generation ago, were strictly rural deities, and their territory was someplace altogether different. So I want to follow up on that proposition. Slum deities are village deities in the city. And maybe in my mind's eye, what I see is a kind of two-branched ethnography, where I want to pursue field work in at least one slum neighborhood in Mumbai, and then sort of toggle back and forth between the urban neighborhood and the village of origin, and, you know, see how religious practices dedicated to perhaps the same divine personalities are developing, how religious practices in the two places are kind of talking to each other and building on each other.
It certainly sounds like a fascinating project, a proposition that the connection between slum deities and once village deities.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. Okay, great. So this has been an interesting chat. We've been speaking today with Dr. William Ellison, who is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We've been speaking with him about his new book, The Neighborhood of Gods, Sacred and the Visible at the Margins of Mumbai. Thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you very much, Raj.
And for all of you out there listening, until next time, keep reading. Take care.
Thank you.